Hello, my friends. Hello, my life warriors, wherever you are in the world. I do hope you're having a good day. Welcome to the Day In, Day Out podcast. This is episode 60, and today I had the immense pleasure of having Mr. Keith Blakemore Noble on. He is the UK's number one fair strategist. He is also a coach, speaker, author, entertainer, trainer, and yeah, show host. Basically, what he does, he helps transforms people's deepest fears into their greatest strengths. Very interesting fellow, I've got to say. Some of the things he was talking about and where he's come from, quite amazing. So please sit back, enjoy the show, and yes, please subscribe, leave a message, and yeah, we'll love to have you back. Anyway, have a great day, be awesome, and yes, we'll speak to you soon. Peace. Hello, my friends. Hello, my life warriors, wherever you are in the world. Welcome to the Day In, Day Out podcast. This is podcast number 60. Oh, and today I have the extreme pleasure of having Keith Blakemore Noble, who is a fear strategist. He helps transform deepest fears into their greatest strengths. How are you today, sir?
I am doing fabulously as always. Thank you very much. You are fabulous. And your good self?
I'm good. I am well. I am well recharged from the weekend. Celebration, joy, and a smile on my face. Yes. Like, may I ask, like, one of the things, like, when someone goes fear strategist, I think of it one way, but I think it's completely wrong. It's like, are you just coming up with like little tactics to deal with people's fears, or is it something more than that?
Interesting question. Yeah, and it's always revealing to see where people go with that, and it's a nice insight into how it was working for you. The term. The reason I use fear strategist is, well, the fear side, obviously, because that's what I help people with. I help people transform their deepest fears into their greatest strengths. All that fears and phobias. So I guess the focus is on the strategist side. Why strategist? Now, I've known a lot of people, I've known a lot of people over the years who call themselves a fear guru or a fear expert, or all these sorts of things. But for me, the reason I call it strategist is there's kind of a couple of bits to it. And certainly part of it kind of fits into my previous life, as it were, before I got into all of this 10 years ago. I used to work in IT. So I had a 20-year career in IT. And in IT, a lot of what you do is very much strategy driven, as in there's a problem with something. You don't just sort of go, oh, I don't know, let's bash around, see if things work.
Turn it off and on.
Yeah, that's the one. Turn it off, throw it out the window sometimes, but you kind of have to go through a process to figure out what's going on. And also, when you're going through, you've kind of figured out what you think it might be. You've got an idea of how you would address it. You don't then just go, right, I know, we do steps 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, that'll fix it. Go through 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and don't test them. And then you find, well, it went wrong at step 2, but we just carried on anyway, and it doesn't work. You've got to keep testing as you're going through. I'm going to do this step. Did I get the results I was expecting? If so, go to the next step. If not, change what you're doing. So that's a lot of what was involved with IT. And when I moved into doing what I do now with fears, I mean I know of people who go, oh yeah, fears are simple, we just go through this process and your fear will be gone. And yet for a fair number of people that would work, but it doesn't work for everyone. And if you go through that process and it hasn't worked, then where do you go? So for me, strategy covers both my approach and the client's approach, because whenever we do anything, we have strategies for how we do it. anything that we do. I mean, if you make your breakfast in the morning, you have a strategy for how to make the breakfast. You're not consciously aware of that strategy. You're probably doing it on autopilot. If you're anything like me, you're stumbling around the kitchen half asleep. You're definitely not thinking you're on autopilot, but it's following that strategy. And so it is when there's a fear. There's a strategy that tells us it's time to be scared. Mm-hmm. There's a strategy that tells us how to be scared. So part of what I do is helping to uncover what tells you it's time to be scared, and how do you know how to do fear? What tells you what you do with fear? Because once you understand those strategies, then you can start to address the situation.
Okay.
So it's strategy from that side, and you can kind of put in help the person to install new strategies. So instead of, oh, this happens, therefore I need to be scared, it's, oh, this happens, therefore that's cool, let's carry on. You've got a new way of dealing with it. So the strategy from that side and strategy from my side, which is figuring out what's going on for the person, figuring out where it came from, strategy to work out what we need to do for them to help them, and then actually implementing all that. So it's strategy is a very, very big part of successfully helping someone to completely conquer a fear or phobia. So that kind of coupled with the way I used to work when I was in IT, it kind of just felt like a natural fit for your strategy. Just that just feels right. That really encapsulates what I'm doing. And it's kind of gone from there.
Okay. So do you like set people goals and targets to overcome like their fear? Because like if you had it on, say, a smart sort of thing, like setting targets achievable, measurable, and timely in that type of situation. Mm-hmm. Like, do you do that with fear, or how, like, what some of the processes behind that?
Yeah, no, cool. Another really good question. And generally for fears, fears or phobias, which is kind of the same sort of thing. Phobia is just a particular type of fear. So we'll just call it all fear for now. For these sorts of fears, the vast majority of the time, it's a single session that, bam, it's gone. So there's none of this, oh, let's work together for 6 months and we'll just, right, come in, do the session, bam, it's gone. So there's not really that much time to kind of set smart goals and objectives and so on, because you come in at the start, you've got the fear, you leave at the end of the session, it's gone. because what it's all about is helping people learn new ways to behave. Now, that may sound a bit strange, but the key to understanding how it all works is to realize that nobody is born scared of anything. We're not born scared of anything. As anyone who's had like new babies or really young infants will know, they're not scared of anything when they're really young. Mm. The parents are freaking out the whole time because this young thing is trying to put the whole world into its mouth, trying to climb over everything. But the young child, we're not scared of anything. We have to be taught a healthy respect for the fears and the dangers and the hazards which life poses us. So we learn fear. And sometimes it's a very good thing for us to learn. For example, learning that sticking your hand in the fire is going to hurt and injure you. It's good to learn that healthy respect. No, let's just keep away from that. But sometimes, even though we're doing the best we can with what we've got, and even though our parents are doing the best that they can, sometimes the lesson doesn't quite get learned in a way that serves us well. There are basically three main ways in which we learn phobias. One is we learn by having a nasty experience, and we decide, oh, that means whatever it is death, is terrifying, it's deadly.
Yeah.
I'm going to stay away from that forever. So we have a really strong emotional event. For example, you might be young, 3-year-old, out with your parents. You're in the play park. Your parents are off speaking with other grown-ups, being really boring. So you go off exploring. All of a sudden, this dog comes bounding up towards you, barking away. You're not really sure what to do. You scream. Your parents then start shouting and screaming at the dog to get away and at you to come to them. Mm. Your little 3-year-old mind is going, oh my God, this is dangerous. That thing could eat me. Ah! Because you see your parents freaking out. And when you're that young, your parents, they're kind of like gods. They're totally unflappable. And if they think this is dangerous, it really must be dangerous. Mm. And that kind of gets seared into the brain. So that as you grow up, anytime you see a dog, a core part of your brain, which is responsible for identifying threats, identifying things which could kill us, goes, oh, deadly. Klaxons go on, you go on red alert. The adrenaline starts pumping, getting you ready to run or fight for your life. Mm. By the time the rest of your mind's caught up and gone, no, wait, hang on, it's just a wee dog. That's absolutely fine. Your body's in full fight or flight mode. You've got that full fear, that full panic, that full phobia going. Which is why you can't sort of rationalize yourself out of a fear, because by the time your logical mind is going, actually, this is all perfectly safe, there's nothing to worry about, you're already in full panic mode. So that's one way in which we can learn how to do a fear. The second way is if we see, we learn by observation. So for example, suppose a parent is terrified of spiders. Every time they see a spider, they freak out. Mm-hmm. We kind of fairly quickly make the association, oh, that, whatever it is, scary. Okay, I got that. I know how we act. Whenever we see one of those, we freak out because that's what my parents are doing. Got it. So that's the second way we've learned a fear. Well, the third way is we get taught it, actively taught it by it, usually by an adult. And a great example of this, four words, which I'm confident every listener has had said to them when they were growing up, not just once, but multiple times. Don't talk to strangers. How often do we get told, don't talk to strangers? And absolutely, when we're young, that is absolutely life-saving advice. No two ways about it. Life-saving advice. But here's the thing. When was the last time anyone said to you, hey, you know what? You're big enough and old enough. You know how to look after yourself. You know, it's okay to talk to strangers. Mm. Nobody ever tells us this. Is it any wonder so many people grow up scared of speaking with strangers? Well, so yeah. That's a kind of, yeah, it makes sense, right? Because well, you've been growing up, you're taught, don't talk. And of course, it's never said, hey, don't talk to strangers. Because there's lots of fear coming from it, from the adult side. And it sort of comes across as, don't you dare talk to strangers, because if you talk to strangers, they will kill you to death. And mummy and daddy will be very upset, and it'll all be your fault because you spoke to a stranger. Like, okay, I'll never speak to anyone ever again.
Yeah. If it's said like that, yes, I can see how that can leave a lasting impression. It does,
like, and even when we don't say it like that, it's just the whole body language, the tonality, the fear that's coming across.
Yeah.
That's kind of how it comes across. It's like, oh my God, huh? I better not talk to strangers. Oh, it kind of gets really seared in there. So we learn how to do phobias and learn how to do fears. Mm. So in order to conquer them, what we need to do is learn new ways of behaving, learn new associations. Because the key thing in all of those is we've learned that this thing means danger. And there's lots of strong negative emotion around it. And when you can eliminate that emotion and learn a new meaning, put new meaning to the context, because now we've got years of hindsight, we can apply that to the lessons that we learned and realize that actually that tiny little spider doesn't mean death and danger. That tiny little spider means, well, it means nothing really. It's minding its own business. And we've got rid of all the negative emotion that's around it. We can learn that new meaning. Because it's an important thing. Nothing means anything. So if something happens, that doesn't mean anything. Mm-hmm. Things only mean what we give, the meaning we give to them. And if you're young and terrified, you might decide that thing means scary. But with the benefit of hindsight, when we're grown up and we've got rid of the negative emotion around it, and we can look back on it and we can go, actually, you know what? That doesn't mean that at all. It actually means something positive. And we can then absorb that learning, mm-hmm, and go forward. Now, I say that's all we do with it. Obviously, it's you can't, as I said, you can't do that logically with the logical mind. which is where coaching and therapy and hypnosis and NLP and so on come in. It's all working with the unconscious mind to help it make that change without the conscious mind getting in the way and going, oh, no, wait, no, but that's not true. Mm. That's where the key lies. But yeah. That's kind of the gist of what we do.
Yeah, because as I listen to you, like basically not having to deal with a fear and everything like this, it in many respects is helping people master a pattern of behavior, whereas the pattern of behavior would be shock, terror, fear, let me flee, run, and whatever, to being like, okay, this is not, if there is some type of danger to it, let me be a little bit more calm about it and react in much more of a better and more timely fashion. Rather than like be, how can I put it, like Kermit the Frog running off stage, if you get what I mean. yeah.
So, that is a great visual. Great image has come up there. Yeah, I know exactly what you mean.
Yeah. So like basically, helping mastering those patterns of behavior and like helping them become much more of a better person to deal with situations which would paralyze them in the past.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, something to remember is sometimes having that little bit of fear or apprehension is still a good thing. I mean, if somebody was terrified of heights, such that they couldn't even go up a step ladder, and it's like, and they conquer that fear of heights, that doesn't mean they're going to climb to the top of the tallest roof and run along the ridge tiles going, yeah, would be endangering life.
Yeah.
So you still have a healthy respect, but it's a healthy respect for heights, a respect for the situation. It's like running along those roofs, that ridge or that roof, that would be dangerous. Standing here on this platform, this is safe. Mm. And it's enabling you to process the difference. You know, right, well, I can stand here and I can admire the view. I'm not going to climb up that because that would be stupid, but I can stand up here way up high and I can admire the view, for example. So you still have that healthy respect for whatever it is.
Mm-hmm. Fantastic. And like basically with these methods, like I can see it says you've helped over 5,000 people with this. Was that one-on-one? Was that group seminars? How did you like get around to doing that?
It's been a combination. Some of it have been one-on-one clients in person. A lot of the time I work with people over Zoom and before that Skype. So I've been doing that for several years, long before everybody cottoned on to the likes of remote working and Zoom and such like. So, I mean, as we're recording this, it's kind of hopefully, fingers crossed, toward the tail end of the COVID pandemic.
I say nothing. Yes.
But one thing that's come up from that is so many people now are completely fine with things like Zoom. Whereas in the past, what I often used to find was you have to spend a fair bit of time convincing people you could do these things online and then talking them through how to install it and set it all up and everything. Whereas now, say to someone, how are we going to do it? Well, we'll do it by Zoom. Okay, you'll send me the link. Yep, I'm done. So people are a lot more comfortable with technology these days. But yeah, some of it is, a lot of it's done in person or one-on-one over Zoom. Mm. And a lot of it has been done through group sessions, seminars, workshops, books, all that sort of thing.
Yeah. But with those 5,000 people, there are your typical fears, heights, spiders, snakes, and stuff like this. What has been one of the, how can I say, more unique fears you've like ever come across in your like sort of your 10-year career?
Gotcha. I think the one that stands out for me, slightly delicate one, but it's nothing too extreme, don't worry. But it was a lady who had a phobia of vomit. Whether that was her vomiting or seeing vomit or other people vomiting or even the thought that somebody might throw up was enough to send her into a full panic attack, which is... quite unpleasant, as you can imagine. Yeah. I mean, space informant isn't the nicest of things anyway.
Yeah.
But having the phobia meant she found it really difficult to do things like go on a flight on a plane, because what if the plane hits turbulence and what if somebody feels sick and ends up throwing up in the air sick bag? And that was enough to instill a fear of flying. And what if you're getting a bit nervous before you're going to do something? Sometimes when you get a bit nervous, you start to feel a little bit nauseous, and that would just make it feel even worse. Just the thought of, well, I can't do that because what if I start feeling sick? And it was a big problem for her because she was a dancer. She lived in New Zealand, and she was often asked to perform in places like the US with the troupe that she worked with.
So
getting nervous, before you go on stage, you're going to have a little bit of nerves. I mean, everybody, you're not human if you don't get that little frisson of excitement and nerves. Like, ooh! It was enough to, which kind of really got difficult for her. Because, like, oh God, what if I start feeling sick? Oh my God. Oh. And then of course, oh, we've got to fly. Oh. So that was causing her all sorts of problems. We did it. We worked together over Zoom because she was in New Zealand and I'm in the UK. This was late last year. We worked together over Zoom. A couple of weeks later, I get a photo. She sent a photo over Facebook of her on stage in Los Angeles, I think it was.
Nice.
She's like, yay, loving it. She said, very restful flight. Felt absolutely fine on the flight. No problems going on. Yeah, there's a wee bit of turbulence, but slept through it. But yeah, I think that's one of the more unusual ones. Although one I've not come across personally, but I have read of cases, somebody who had a fear of a color. The color yellow seems to be, I mean, it's not many people have fears of colors, but of colors when people have fears, yellow seems to be the more common one. And that's quite an interesting one.
Well, yellow, I don't know when yellow became so menacing, but still. But I have a fear of color. Like, fair enough. Yeah, that is unusual. Yeah. But yeah, I remember watching a documentary where they were talking about fears, and like this lady had a fear of pigeons, and it made me giggle because I watched it and I saw this lady it was kind of reenacted and everything like this, and like about a year ago I saw someone who like was pigeons were there and they were like doing everything in their power to avoid the pigeon. They were acting like this lady, just like, oh no, don't let the pigeon get me. Oh God, ducking and diving. I was like, but you know what? I kind of go, don't be silly. It's only a pigeon, but like they could turn around and go, don't be silly. It's only a spider, if you get what I mean. Like snake. Exactly. Yeah. Snake's a different story because they can come after you. But yeah.
I mean, you touched on a good thing there, a really important point there. Phobias, it is an irrational fear. That's part of the definition of phobia, is an intense, irrational fear of something that poses you no real threat. But here's the thing, and I used to have three phobias when I was younger, so I've experienced it. I know what it's like going through them. Here's the thing. Even though you have a phobia, even when you're in the midst of that panic attack, you know it's irrational. You know the thing can't hurt you or harm you, but it doesn't help because your mind has already put you on full red alert, and the adrenaline's going, and the heart's pumping like mad, and you're sweating. It's like, I know it's irrational. I know it can't hurt me, but So it's the bizarre things about phobias and telling someone, oh, get over it, it can't hurt you, it's irrational. I know, it doesn't help.
No, like this is the thing, like I'm not a fan of spiders myself, like anyone listening, anyone watching, I'm not a fan of spiders, but one of the things when helped me get comfortable with spiders was my first trip to the United States. Okay, I was working as a summer camp as a counselor. The camp I was in, Camp High Road, the way they describe it was rustic. So, like, yes. So, yeah. So, no sort of flushing toilets, outhouse and everything like this. Beginning of summer, you go into the outhouse, and if you look up, you might see little spiders. They're called wolf spiders. This is the thing. They start out small at the beginning of the summer, but each week you go back, they get that little bit bigger. There was a couple of times I walked in, I like about to sit down, that glanced up and went, my reaction was like, nope. Just like, not today. Not today. I'm gonna no, not today. Bye bye. Like, yeah, but yeah, but it took about 2 months of being out there before I was like, okay, you stay up there, don't come down. Or it's going to be all over and there'll be me running out screaming, like, what's that? And me going, ah! But yeah, like, that's helped me get a little bit more comfortable. I won't say, like, if a big spider came into this room now, yeah, I'll most probably just leave the house and just basically leave my lady to deal with that for forever, like, time immemorial. Yeah, I'll be back. Okay, we'll move. That's like, just and that'll be it. But yeah, but I've got to say, like, being around it helped, but I wouldn't say I'm like completely over it, but you know what I mean. I'll get there one day.
I totally get you, what you mean. And for some people, they do find that kind of forcing themselves to gradually be exposed a bit more and a bit more and a bit more, they do develop a tolerance for whatever it is, or they at least develop the ability to kind of keep the worst of the symptoms under control. And that works for some people. For a lot of people, it has the opposite effect. They try doing that, and it just makes it worse and worse because it really reinforces the fear for them. Certainly when I work with people, we never do any exposure therapy or any of that sort of stuff. Because it's like, I'm scared of this. Oh, you're scared of this? Yeah. How's that going to help? we don't do any of that sort of thing. But for some people, undoubtedly, there are people who have gone, oh, well, I'm just going to go face to face with the thing that terrifies me and I will find a way to come through it. And for some people, that can work. Doesn't work too well for a lot of people, unfortunately.
Yeah, what were your three fears? Because you, like, I took you off track slightly with my little story, but yeah. What were your
That's three? All right. My three fears. One was heights. Okay. I would be terrified of heights. And it was bizarre. When I went to university, I joined the mountaineering club thinking, hey, if anything's going to help me get over my fear of heights, it will be this. Okay. And I would climb up anything. I'd abseil off anything. Absolutely fine, because of course you're strapped in, you've got the harness, the ropes, no problems at all. But when we were on the climbing wall, actually in the indoor climbing wall with big crash mats down below, so even if you fall, you're fine. I couldn't climb more than about 2 feet at the most off the ground if I didn't have ropes on. It's like, so that didn't do anything.
Okay. So you were perfectly fine. Like, if we went, okay, we're going to go off to, say, Ben Nevis, and we're going to climb Ben Nevis. You're perfectly fine up in Ben Nevis and stuff like this. But as soon as you got in the room, like, yeah, a perfectly controlled environment, it was like, nah, sorry. Wow.
Exactly. I mean, one time we did abseiling off the university library to raise funds for the mountaineering club. So we'd charge people £1 or whatever and rope them up, and they would abseil down the library. And I abseiled down it, absolutely no problem. And this is like, I don't know, 10-story building, abseiled down it. Whee, yeah, no problem. Great fun. Because you're on the ropes and everything. But I climb up more than a couple of feet, just like, ooh, actually, no, I'm just going to, so that was kind of bizarre. And it would even be things like, you know, sometimes you'll go sightseeing and there'll be a monument and you can walk up, climb up the stairs inside it and then have a good look at the beautiful panoramic views. I would climb up the stairs, kind of be going, oh, I'm not too keen on this. Get to the top where it's all safe railings around it. You're perfectly safe there. I'd be kind of there with the camera going, click, 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 click. Right, I've got lots of photos. I'm going to go back down now.
go on. I was going to say, I tell you one thing, that there, you most probably seen videos of it, the glass bridge in China.
Yes, yes.
That, I don't go there because I've seen people.
Yeah, so back in those days, you would never get me to even be able to stand before you even get on the bridge looking at it. I'd be, no. Nowadays, we're like, oh, yeah, come on, let's walk across the bridge. Hey, this is cool. The second phobia I had was spiders. Really common one. Spiders that I was freak out, like freeze. Like, oh. I remember one day I was helping some friends move house. And so two of us were in the garage, shifting all the stuff out. And there's a huge sheet of wood against one of the walls. Ooh, we moved it. No. And there were loads of spiders there.
No.
Now, David and I were both terrified of spiders. So we moved the thing, spiders scampering everywhere. We're both over 6 foot tall. We're both well built. So spiders are no threat to us at all. Both backs against the other wall going, oh, I wish they'd hurry up and go. Let's never tell anyone about this. Nah, you're
right. Yeah, if I was there, all you would have heard was the door closing and me on the other side.
But it took us a bit of courage to summon up the courage to actually get to the door, because that meant going past a load of the spiders. Right, nowadays, spiders, fine, no bother. Oh, look, spiders, cool. I'll just help them out of the way. And the third one was, I used to think it was that I lacked confidence and I was shy. Mm. I now know it was social phobia. I was terrified of speaking with strangers. I mean, for example, you and I could not be doing this call back in those days. How can I jump on a call with someone I've never spoken to before? Oh, no, that would just be too scary. These days, no problem at all. I absolutely fine going to events where I don't know anyone, come away knowing loads of people.
Yeah, because like this is the thing. Like you're down as a speaker as well. So like being socially awkward, speaking in front of crowds of like most probably 50, 100 plus. What is the largest crowd you've spoken in front of?
Largest one so far is 800.
800.
Smallest one was, if you don't count one-on-one conversations, the smallest one was a group of three and various in between. And absolutely fine. Before I conquered all my stuff, there was no way I could have been a speaker.
Mm.
No way I could have done any of that. Now it's like, yeah, brilliant. Come on, let's do this. Let's have some fun while we do it.
No, that's great. No, that's fantastic. So what events have you been speaking at over the course of time? How long have you been speaking? What type of events have you been speaking at? Two.
I'm trying to think back to when my first speaking event would have been, probably about 8 years ago, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
So I've done various ones, a lot of speaking to people, teaching, taking people through personal different aspects of personal development, talking to people about phobias. I've also done a lot of teaching people NLP and hypnosis, actually training people in all those sorts of things. So those tend to be the main sorts of things I speak with people about. Event that I did quite a few of was helping people to develop their confidence, actually have the confidence to be able to indulge in small talk with people at parties, for example, all that sort of thing.
Fantastic. Doing small talk. I don't do small talk. I do only big talk. So like this is the thing, like you've been a speaker, like, well, you're a coach one, like you've helped over 5,000 people. And you're also an author. How many books have you produced?
I have produced 4 books so far. Mm-hmm. Now, what I did with each of these books was I got various experts together. I approached various experts, got them each to contribute a chapter. Now, we're not talking about 2 or 3 page quick knock something off. We're talking 20, 30 pages. Mm. So it's a good chunk of information about their particular expertise. And so I've done 4 of those books so far, called Winning in Life and Work, because it's all about helping you win in life and work. The first one came about kind of by accident. I was in an advanced speaker training course, and somebody spoke about why writing books is a good way of helping get get stuff out to people. And they said, what people sometimes do is they collaborate, they get a group together and they each write a chapter and create, do the book between them. Which sounded like a good idea. And I kind of put a sheet of paper up at the front saying, look, anyone's interested in doing this, pop your name down. Let's see if we can sort something out, hoping that somebody would organize it. Got about a dozen people all saying, yeah, I'd love to be part of that. Weeks passed by, nobody was doing anything. And I thought, well, I want to be in this book. Nobody else is doing anything. I suppose I'll have to stand up and say, right, I'll organize it. Which I did. And we got the first book done. And it was an absolute nightmare, as you can imagine, trying to herd. It's like herding cats, getting 12 different people all to contribute.
Yeah.
Got the book finished, published it, and I remember distinctly saying, well, I'm never doing that again. And then about a year later, I was thinking, actually, that wasn't that bad. And I've learned a fair bit from it. I wouldn't make the same mistakes again. Let me see if I can get a group of people together and we'll do another one.
Yeah. What did you learn from the first book to the second book to make things better?
I think the biggest things I learned was make sure that you have total clarity on every single step of the way. Don't assume everybody else is going to know what needs to be done. Make sure you've got total clarity and really lay it out in very, very simple steps. Because otherwise people will all go off on different directions and you end up with a complete mess. So that's kind of true for leading anything, really. Make sure you know exactly where you're going. Make sure you know exactly what you need to do to get there. Make sure everybody knows what they need to do and why they're doing it, how that contributes to the overall goal, and keep everyone invested in the overall goal, so that when things get difficult, when tempers get frayed, when people start going, oh, you know what? I don't know why I'm bothering with this. They do know why, because they can see that bigger goal and they're invested in it just as much as you and everyone else is. It's like, oh, this really sucks. I absolutely hate this, but it's going to be worth it. Let's find a way through it.
I like that. I like that a lot. So So the other, like book 3 and 4, how did that go? Was it far smoother or was it different, like different challenges arose from that?
I would love to say books 3 and 4 were plain sailing, but I would be lying. book 3, again, after book 2, I said, no, that's it. I'm never doing another one again.
Yeah.
And then about a year later, again, I was thinking, actually, overall, it was okay. And I know a lot more now about the process. And yeah, we'll do it. It'll be fine. And again, it was another nightmare. Not making the same mistakes, just whole new challenge. Loads of new challenges come up. Lots of new difficulties and so on. Then after that, I said, that's it. Calling it a day. 3 books, that's fine. That's enough. I'm not doing any more. And then again, about a year later, I ended up stumbling into a project where we ended up doing book 4. Which had a different, unique set of challenges. Got that book out. That came out last year. And this time I didn't say never again. I just said, well, that's 4 books out. I have no plans for a fifth one in the series. But who knows? Maybe a fifth one will come along. Maybe it won't.
Do you think you'll make a book all by yourself, a solo effort?
Yes, and the reason I know that is I'm currently writing two of them, which is a ridiculous way to do it. But I'm
okay.
I'm writing a book about fears and phobias.
Yeah,
good. Makes sense, right? excuse me. So I'm creating that book, and that's going to be a decent size of a book. It's going into answering lots and lots and lots of questions that people have around them. There's a network organization that I'm part of, and as part of that, they have like a 20-minute segment in each meeting where somebody gets to stand up and do a talk. And they're very clear, it's not a sales pitch, but it's a talk about something interesting or sharing information with people or whatever. And I was never able to attend those, even though they were spread across much of the UK, because I live way up in the northeast of Scotland. And the nearest meeting to me would have been an 8-hour round trip by car, which is a long way to go for an hour and a half meeting.
Wait, how far northeast are you? Like, because
I am up kind of halfway between Aberdeen and Inverness.
Okay.
And the nearest one would have been down. Sorry, go on.
I was going to say on the coast or inland.
About 6 miles from the coast. Yeah.
No, that's too far north. I was going to say, yeah, no, Peter Head, like, yeah, being around there because, yeah, Aberdeen, no, you're too, that's more north, I believe.
Yeah.
Well, okay.
So it would have been a long old trip. But with everything that happened with COVID, all the meetings went online. Mm-hmm. So I was able to dive in, started going to the meetings. Started doing my talk and taking it around various of the different meetings because I only got about 80 different meetings a week at the moment. So I've got three different talks which I take round, and one of the talks proved really, really popular and kept being asked to do that one over and over and over again. And some people would I've had people come to me and say, hey, this is the fourth or this is the fifth time I've heard this talk. I came to this meeting specifically to hear this talk. Because I always get something new from it every time.
Oh, that's fantastic.
I was thinking, wow, this is really resonating with people. And there's a lot more that can go into with this. And it's sort of a topic which really applies across the board. So I put the phobia book on hold temporarily. I'm writing the book around this, expanding upon the theme, because 20 minutes doesn't give you much time to go in depth. So expanding upon the themes, and that book for September, and then the phobia book will come out probably in February of next year. So yes, I will be doing solo books.
Yeah, two off the bat, just keeping it nice and light. Yeah, you know what I mean. Well, yeah. Different subject matters completely. Yeah, you know, yeah. I'm glad to see you doing the
email.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, the way I see it is I never plan these books anymore. The books tell me, hey, I need to be written. Oh, okay, right. Let's write it and get it out. And the good thing from doing the four books, although there were major headaches and lots of hassles and stresses and so on, the good thing about doing it, because self-publish it every time, because it's hard enough getting a publishing house to take you on.
Yeah.
Even harder if you're doing it as a group effort. Like, hey, there's a dozen of us writing this book. Hey, would you like to take this on? No. So self-published every time. Done that often enough that I know the process, know all the pitfalls, know what you need to do to do all of that. Got my own sort of publishing arm of my company set up with all the ISBNs and everything, which means, and I've also got contacts through all of that for doing the proofreading and doing the cover design, all these sorts of things, which takes a lot of stress out of it. So although this is the first solo book I've written, it's not my first time publishing, which makes life a lot easier for me. So in a way, it's been kind of good going through that whole process, because now I'm coming to write my book. I don't have to worry about, how do we handle all the rest of it? I've handled all the rest of it. Now I'm bringing my book into that process. So it's been educational along the way, and it's all kind of all working out nicely, I think, so far, touch wood.
Yes. You say it's self-published. Who do you use to help self-publish your books?
All right. So I've got someone who does proofreading. Mm-hmm. And I've got someone who does cover design, who's doing the cover design. Then when it comes to actually publishing the book, I've registered my own block of ISBNs. You know, it's a 13-digit number that's assigned to each different title.
Yeah,
I've registered a block of those, which means if you look those up, the publisher is me. Yay! Right. I use a company that does print on demand, a company called Ingram Spark, which is quite a big one, used by a lot of places. They do the whole set it all up with them. They will then do print on demand. Because there's two ways you can do it. You can either print on demand, or you can print, do a print run and then try and sell those. Now, if you do a print run, The individual copies are cheaper because you're doing it in bulk. But if you do a print run of 1,000 and then sell 10 books, you've left with 990 books. Do it the on-demand way. They print the books as and when they're required. So it costs a little bit more, but you don't have any stock to worry about.
Right.
Also, they work through all the booksellers. So any of the bookstores, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, all the online ones, as well as the bricks and mortar stores, can all order the books as and when they're needed through that company. So they handle the printing and physical distribution. And then on the ebook side of it, I register it with each of the different ebook providers because I've gone through that process before. So now I know the shortcuts, because there are companies who will do that for you and they'll do it for a hefty fee. If you know what you're doing, it's right. Here's where I do it with Amazon. Here's where I do it with Apple. Here's where I do it with Barnes & Noble. Upload it to each of the different ones.
I imagine it would be time consuming. Is it easier when you, like, if you're doing an ebook one by one to do the whole thing, but it's just a case of you just got to go to every sort of place which does an ebook, if you get what I mean?
I totally get what you mean. You've got two options. You can either go through the centralized one where, hey, give us your ebook and we'll register it with all the different places for you.
Yeah.
And we'll charge you a big fee to do that.
Mm.
Or if you know how to register it with each of the others. Now, the beauty, when we did the first books, we didn't have any money to pay other people to do all this. So I had to figure it all out. So basically, I had to figure it all out, how to do all of this. And once you figured it out once, it's then so much easier to then just go back and do the same thing. It's like, okay, I know to get it in here, I know this is the files that I need. This is where I do it. Done. So now it's spend a couple of hours one evening and have it uploaded to all the different places.
Yeah, no, like this is the thing. I like that. I like it. I like that initiative, because this is the thing. There are many people who go, yeah, I've got a book in me, only if I could do this. And the first sort of stumbling block they have is like they go try to get it published and like they get shut down by gatekeepers time and time again. But now there's that option for people to like go forward with their own book and go, I'm going to publish it. But
yeah.
You know what I mean? They sometimes don't know about all the different little steps they need to take to get that done. But yeah.
Absolutely. I mean, there are pros and cons of both approaches. If you attempt to get a publishing deal, it can be very hard.
Mm.
It can be a lot of work involved with that. I've got a friend who writes fiction, and he's now got a book actually published through a publisher. Mm. It took him several years to get there. But the end result is he now has a book through a publisher. He has now been asked to write another book. So he's doing another one. He knows it's going to be easier to get it published because they're doing it. Plus the whole process of going through all of that, there was so much editing and re-editing and redrafting that the finished book is a much, much stronger product, which is especially important for fiction. Very, very important for fiction. So I was lucky enough to see one of the early versions of the book and the published version of it, and the earlier version was good. Don't get me wrong, it was a good story, it was well written. And then you see the finished one, it's like, wow, that is just taking it to a whole new level, which would never have happened had he not gone through that route. He could have self-published and it would still have been a good book.
Yeah,
but now it's through a small indie publisher who work with authors just in a particular genre, but that means it's now building. He's now building up his reputation in there.
Mm.
On the other side, you can, if you do it all yourself, yes, you can guarantee that you'll get your book published, but you don't necessarily have the benefits that the help of all the other aspects that the traditional publishing houses will do. You have to make sure you handle those yourself. So it's. Either way, there's a lot of work involved and there's a lot of cost, whether it's money or whether it's time.
Mm.
You just have to be aware and be prepared to invest either the money or the time. As I say, I get all of them into the Barnes & Noble and Amazon and everything. I do that all myself. And these days I can do it in a couple of hours or so. Mm-hmm. But it still took years to learn all of that and to get to the stage of being able to do that, which is why, yes, there are companies who will do that for you for a nice fee. But hey, if you don't want to spend all the time it takes to learn how to do it in those 2 hours, absolutely pay that company who will do it for you. There's absolutely nothing wrong with that. It's just, and had we had the money when we did the first book, we would have probably said, probably bought one of those whole publish it for you services. Like, here's the thing, just go and publish it, please.
Yeah.
But we didn't have the money, so we had to do it that way. And now we just build on having, now that I've got those skills and knowledge, it makes sense to use it.
Liking it. Look, you should, like, basically, you've got coach, speaker, author, entertainer, trainer, host on there. You should have publishing house, like, just, like, etch somewhere on your, like, on your profile as well, like, because
that's a thought, isn't it?
It is. Brings me on to another point. Do you have a podcast? Is that right, or is it like, I know you've got a YouTube channel, which it looks like you've got video, like you are interviewing people, like it's a podcast. Is that correct, or do you have a podcast as well?
Yeah, I've got a podcast. It's very imaginative title, The Keith Blakemore Noble Radio Show. Mm. Hey, why not? Does what it says on the tin, as they say. Yeah. So I have the podcast, and the videos from that also go on YouTube because, let's face it, you've got content to share with people. You want to get it where the people are. You don't want them to have to come and find you. You get it to where they are. So some people love listening to podcasts. Some people love catching videos on YouTube. So yeah, it covers both angles there.
Excellent. How many people have you interviewed for your podcast so far?
Oh, you know, I honestly don't know. And the reason I don't know is when I first started, I ended up actually doing 2 shows a week. In slightly different fields. One was called Winning in Life and Work, which was based very much on the premise of the books. And so it was interviewing, sometimes it was interviewing guests from the books, sometimes it was interviewing other people on those sorts of topics. And that ran for a year or so. So there must have been 50 guests or so on that. And I also did my own show kind of around the field of confidence and that sort of thing. And that ran for a year or so. So some of those episodes were me solo. Some of them were episodes with a guest. So 20 or 30 on that at least. So that's probably about 80 guests. Then it kind of, doing 2 shows a week, as you can imagine, is, well, it's stupid, quite frankly. I wish I'd never started it. But hey, you do learn these things.
You're preaching to the choir here. I upload 2 episodes a week. Yeah, but like, you know what I mean? Like doing 2 shows, yeah. I've already got plans to do another podcast with my lady, but that's another story. But yeah.
I mean, if you're focusing on podcasts, doing 2 a week is fine. For me, the podcast was kind of like, this is just an additional thing to help. It's like, it's taking so much time. So in the end, I culled those. Took a break going, right, I'm not doing any podcasting anymore. Mm. And then after a few months, I thought, actually, there's a common theme here, isn't there? So actually, you know what? Let's learn from everything that went on with those. Learn from the bad points. Take all the good points. And let's distill it into a single show. So those were each 1 hour long. So it was 2 1-hour podcasts a week. Now I do 20 to 30 minute podcast per week, which is a lot easier to create and edit and so on. And also I've found for the type of thing that I do, people kind of like the 20 to 30 minute sort of quick look into particular topics or a discussion with someone. And if there's a guest who's a really popular guest, can always bring them back later. So for the way I work, that works nicely. That said, there is also equally the market for the longer in-depth hour longer podcast as well. It just depends which way you're steering things. And for me, because I'm doing it not exclusively as in I'm a podcaster, I'm doing it as in this is another part of how I help people transform their spheres. Obviously, I don't want to take it up. Don't want it to take up loads of time. So we do it that way.
No. It is healthy. It's healthy. I've got to say, you are definitely juggling and spinning a lot of plates all at the same time. Got to say, that is work ethic on its highest order, pushing yourself on a daily basis. So what do you think some of the things are going to hold for you, or you want to achieve in the next, say, 6 months to a year?
What an interesting question. What an interesting question, isn't it? Which is partly made slightly trickier to answer because of the current ongoing global situation. Who knows what's going to happen? I would love to start doing more, or return to doing live speaking events, and also the live entertainment shows. At the moment, that's not a goer. That's absolutely fine. So in the short term, focus, getting on podcasts such as this great one, which I have to say, this is an absolute, I'm thoroughly enjoying this one. It's a great format you've got. I'm loving this.
No worries, I'll send you a check in the mail. Don't worry. Keep it up.
So getting on more shows, having more chats with people to just kind of, actually, everything that I do is about helping people, realize that it's possible to get rid of their fears. And then when they're ready, help them to actually get rid of their fears. And that's why I've got, as you say, there's the six strings there. At one point, each of those were under a different brand name. And so different websites and different Facebook brands. And that's a lot of effort. Until I realized, hang on, it's all the same thing. It's just different, reaching people at different stages on their journey. Some people like to read rather than go for coaching, for example. So it's kind of at the moment building up a lot more on the online side of things. I have some online courses which I'm creating to help people with the phobia side, because for some people, working one-on-one with a coach is perhaps either uncomfortable for them, or it's financially a commitment too far for them at this stage. They know they want to get rid of that fear because they know it's holding them back, but they're just not quite at the stage of being able to commit to what it costs to work one-on-one with someone. So I've managed now to distill because the problem is there's no one-size-fits-all, so you can't simply go, right, you've got a phobia, we'll do this, and it's done. Every time I work with someone one-on-one coaching, it's always bespoke, and we everything from first principles there. But what I have been able to do is kind of create, now it's a bit long, it's about 6 hours long as opposed to 1 hour, which a coaching session is. Okay. But create a longer process which takes people through all the aspects that they need to do so that they can work through it at home and make the changes that they want to do themselves. So that's probably the next big thing for me to polish off and create and launch. Plus, of course, the books.
Well, yes, two books, online coaching, podcasts, as well as speaking on like online events. Ah, boy.
Teach me out of mischief.
Well, yes. I don't know where you could find the time, my friend. I don't know where you could find the time. that is fantastic. It's been an hour of a joyful time. Would you be able to tell people where they'd be able to find you on the global worldwide interweb?
On the global worldwide interweb. Perhaps the easiest way to find me is just to go to my website, which is keithblakemorenoble.com. Mm-hmm. And you'll find what I do there and contact details and everything. Or if you're on social media, on the main platforms, your Facebook, LinkedIn, Instagram, YouTube, all of these ones, I'm on there as Keith Blakemore Noble. That's the username. So you'll find me there.
Perfect. What I'll do, I'll put all of that into the show notes, the episode briefing, all will be there and they'll be able to find you.
Fantastic.
Keith, let me just say thank you. It's been a pleasure having you on today. I will get you on again in the near future, I'm sure. And yes,
I would love
who knows? I might. Who knows where our conversation will take us next? But no doubt, a very good time.
I thoroughly enjoy myself. Thank you so much. And yep, if you want to have me back sometime, let's see what strange areas we can uncover and explore next time. That would be fantastic.
No problem. Like you said, strange. Watch out. Anyway, let me just say thank you to all my friends, my life warriors out there. Whoop, say it, don't spray it. Thank you for watching the show up until this point. I want to just simply say stay well, stay safe, be awesome, be excellent, be fantastic. Be all the positive bees you can be in this world and more. Have a good one. Peace. And we are out.